Accession number 32297, Reel 7.
John Dixon, Reel 7.
So what happened after you disembarked from there?
Well, we didn't have much time left in New York. We weren't allowed free rein, put it that way. We were all kept together. I think we had a bit of a bus tour around, and we looked at the skyscrapers, and you know, we just wondered at the place. It was quite mind-boggling to somebody of my age, just to see this tremendous city. And then we were all in a group, and I think we got eventually to, I think it was, is it Grand Union Station? Anyway, it was something, a magnificent station that we'd all seen and heard about. Marvellous place. Track 29 and all this, you know, the Chattanooga choo-choo type of thing. Anyway, there we all were. Place was alive with people. And eventually we were all mustered onto this train, and we were whisked away through the night and probably all of the next day up to a place called Moncton in Canada, which was in New Brunswick, I think, not far inland from Halifax, which was the other port of call where everybody went in. There was a huge disappointment on the train as far as the accommodation was concerned, because we'd all seen films about these luxurious American trains with sleeping compartments and coloured porters and all these things, and we thought it was all going to be like that. But instead of that, believe it or not, they were hard wooden seats. Rather like the old trams that we used to have. And we were going to be on this thing for at least a night. So trying to make a comfortable bed to sleep on these old seats was not terribly easy. So it was a bit rattly, this train. But it was, that was just the downside of it. The good side of it was every time we drew or slowed down or into some American town, it just seemed, I don't know how they knew it, but the local population, all the young ladies and the men and all that, they came out to welcome the train. And they were handing up bars of chocolate and cakes and anything that was nice, anything you want, lads, you know. We couldn't get off the train, but, you know, it was just this wonderful welcome. And people waving Union Jacks and Stars and Stripes. Just, you wondered how they knew that the train was going to be, or whatever. So the journey, and apart from that, the scenery, of course, was quite interesting until we got nearer Moncton, when it became very much less interesting, as that part of Canada is not terribly scenic. And that was it. But I think we were on the train probably the best part of 48 hours.
What was Moncton like? What was Moncton?
Moncton was a... Well, I think the official title was, again, it was an RAF-run camp, a huge camp, and I think its official title was RAF 31PD, Moncton. And PD meant Personnel Disposal Unit. And I thought, well, are they going to dispose of us? Why bring us all the way to Moncton? But it was a huge camp. The buildings were two-storey barrack blocks, really, and I don't know how many people were there, but probably, again, 8,000-9,000 people there. 90% were RAF, and the idea was, this is where you were until, if you were on your way out for training, you sat there until you were sent off to your flying training schools, and when you went depended on when they were prepared to take you, and that depended on the weather, as to whether the course in front of you had been held up or not. And the RAF people didn't really know where they were going. I mean, by then they probably knew that they were going to be trained as pilots or navigators or whatever, but they didn't know where they were going. And they ended up mainly all over Canada, some as far west as Winnipeg and that sort of area. A few went to American training schools, and then we knew that we were going to Kingston, Ontario, because all the Navy went there, 31 SFTS, Kingston, Ontario. That was the ones going out. Equally there, there were the ones coming back who'd already got their commissions on their wings or whatever. I'll come into that later. But they'd finished their training, and they were waiting for passage home back to the UK. But whether you were going out or coming back, you had no duties to do, and it became a bit of a bore because you didn't know how long you were going to sit there. There we were. We'd flown our Tiger Moss, we thought we knew all about aviation, and we just wanted to get on with it. But we just sat there at Moncton, and I think in our case, probably not more than a couple of weeks, if that. And then off we went to Kingston.
But an element of frustration in all of this.
It would have been better in retrospect if they'd had some sort of program of, even films or lectures or something. There may have been a few, but by and large, we were bored. The food was good. You couldn't fault that side. The comfort was okay. There were plenty of hot water, showers, baths, everything. But we just wanted to get on with it. And nobody could tell you how long you were going to be there. And the other frustrating thing was, of course, we were there. I'd started on the 47th pilot's course. And when you got there, the chances were that you'd caught up with the chaps on the 46th pilot's course who were a month ahead of you. And equally, what was even worse, if the ones coming behind you, they caught up with you. So it was a very frustrating sort of period. But at least we knew where we were going.
And how did you get to Kingston?
I don't know. Train, I expect. Everything was done by train. And don't remember that journey too much. I think we went through, I think we must have seen Quebec. And we went through Montreal. These are the places we knew from a map where we were. We didn't get out at any of these places, I don't think. But it was great just to see these cities that we'd heard about at school.
What were your impressions of Canada initially?
Over the period I was there, I was lucky, really. I did like it. I know you've asked me a difficult question here. When we got there, it was high summer. And when we first got to Kingston, which is on the shores of Lake Ontario, I can remember we were actually swimming in the lake. And I've told you earlier, I'm not much of a swimmer, but my chum Graham, who was a swimmer, he was actually teaching me to dive. And I've got pictures of actually swimming in the lake. So that was the summer. By the time we left, which was December, we were sort of feet deep in snow. And it was a different world. When we got back to Moncton, having got our wings, we were just barely went outside the door. It was so frozen. And there wasn't much to go out for at Moncton.
So, what happened as you arrived at Kingston?
Again, you're asking me a lot of things I can't remember. All I remember is we were wearing khaki shirts and long trousers, and we still had our sailor's hats on, but this was the summer rig, so there was that. And again, I think we were just put into different huts. We were, again, eventually introduced to instructors who were, I think they were all RAF, may have been some Canadians, but I think they were RAF. And again, the same drill, four pupils to each instructor. Two flew in the morning, two did ground school, and vice versa. So it was the same system. The RAF had really got it buttoned up, this training, you know. You've got to hand it to them.
I mean, it sounds very organised, the whole process you're doing.
Oh, yes, yes. Oh, completely. I mean, the only thing that wasn't organised, which they couldn't control, was the timing, which, you know, you imagine if the weather stopped the previous course from completing, or something had happened, or unserviceability, never remembered much of that. So they couldn't guarantee the actual dates that you would start your course. But once you'd started it, and at Kingston, we knew we had 16 weeks to get our wings, or 4 months, which was the drill there. So if you add that on to what we'd done at Elmden, I mean, the total flying period was 6 months, really. But it took longer than that because of the in-between bits, as it were. But no, I think the first time we were there, we were told all the local drills and things we had to learn. We met our instructor.
Who was your instructor?
Well, the first chap I had, I didn't like at all. His name was Flying Officer Gerdes, who, it was rumoured, he never said it, that he had been in the Battle of Britain. I don't know whether that's true, but he obviously hated the idea of being an instructor. He thought he was a hotshot fighter pilot, and he really thought he was wasting his time teaching idiots like us to fly, which was a pity.
Did he take that out on?
No, he didn't say it directly, but he let it be known that he, you know, he was beneath himself doing this job, which it probably was if you look at it from his point of view. But a good instructor doesn't do that. A good instructor instruct you in a good, sensible way. Now, I'm not saying he wasn't a good instructor, but he was a show-off. And I don't know whether I told you this on tape or not, but the first, we were shown a Harvard. We were going to fly North American Harvards, which were lovely little aeroplanes, very powerful for what they were. And we were shown round the cockpit and all this, that and the other the first time. And then without any warning, he said to me one day, Dixon, he said, climb in. And he said, I'm going to take you off and show you this aeroplane and what it does, you see. Well, of course, stupidly, I had no warning that this was going to happen. And I'd stuffed myself with a couple of Hershey bars at lunchtime and a milkshake or something. So I wasn't really set up for what he was going to do. And of course he did throw the aeroplane around. He was just showing off, basically. But he was just showing me about what this aeroplane could do. Now, remember one thing. We'd only ever flown in open cockpit Tiger Moths. And this had a closed cockpit. It had heaters. I don't know whether we had the heater on then, but it was an entirely different atmosphere, the flying under a hood. And the pupil sat in the front in a Harvard, and he was in the back. And he flung this thing all around the sky, all upside down, inside out. And of course, I was airsick. And it's the only time I've ever been airsick, and it completely spoilt my first impressions of A, of flying a Harvard, and B, Flying Officer Gerdes. I didn't think a lot of him at all. And he didn't even say sorry.
So the element there was, as you said, he was just showing off what he could do with the Harvard, was it?
Well, we can say that, but equally, of course, he was showing me what the Harvard could do and what it was about and how you should be able to fly it once you'd mastered it. You know, I wouldn't blame him entirely, but it would have been nice if he'd done the first trip in a more sedate way and made me follow the controls.
Because it almost sounds counterproductive in the sense, because you're bothered being airsick, that you're not going to learn about familiarising yourself with the aircraft as such, are you?
No, it was. I was just too worried about being sick and trying not to be sick and hardier. And of course, the drill then was that if ever anybody was airsick, you either had to clean it all up yourself, or you got the mechanics to do it and you had to pay them. I can't remember what I did. I think I probably paid them. Poor devils. But my Hershey bar didn't last very long, I can tell you that. But I'd never been airsick other than that. But even today, I do not like being flown by somebody else. It doesn't matter in an airline, of course, it's no problem. But in a small aeroplane, if somebody's throwing it about, I don't like it. I'm much happier doing it myself.
Can you tell me about the harbour? Give me a kind of thumbnail sketch of what the aircraft's like, and a little bit about how it's configured, and again with the cockpit, how that's configured in comparison, say, with the Tiger Moth that was very basic.
Well, it's an American aeroplane. North American built it. It's a monoplane, low wing monoplane, with a retractable undercarriage. It's a radial engine, Pratt and Whitney Wasp engine, I think it is, all painted yellow, except in front of the cockpit, just across the cowling, was always black. This was to stop any reflection of the sun or whatever blinding the pilot. So it was a yellow aeroplane, but with a black in front of the cockpit over the cowling. as I say, a low-wing monoplane, quite nippy, very fast. It had brakes which were operated by toe pedals on the rudders, which was different from English aeroplanes, but anyway, toe brakes. And I think that's basically it. The two cockpits, the pupil sat in the front and the instructor sat behind, and the hood slid backwards and forwards, so that's how you opened the hood. And it was quite nippy. I can't tell you the speeds, I don't remember, but I can remember it started up. To start the engine, you switched it all on and did everything, and then you pressed between the two rudders. There was an accelerator pedal between the two, and you pressed, I think it was with your heel, and that started the engine turning over on an inertia thing, and it gradually sort of built up, and you could tell from the noise when the engine was turning over fast enough, and then you pressed forward with your toe, and that sort of ignited the ignition or whatever, and the engine then started up. It had got a propeller control. In other words, you could control the pitch of the propeller. It had got flaps, which we'd never had before, flaps to slow you down for landing. I told you about the brakes. Some of them, later on, we flew Harvards, which had got radios in. The initial ones we had didn't have radios. And the other thing was that they made quite a peculiar noise, and you can still occasionally see them flying here if somebody's some enthusiast has got them, because the propeller apparently, I don't understand the mechanics, but as the propeller spun round, the tips of the propeller actually were exceeding the speed of sound. And it made this lovely sort of raspberry noise if you sort of tended to overspeed the propeller. So that's how you can always tell a Harvard, particularly when it's doing aerobatics, because it will make this lovely sort of raspberry noise, I suppose, is the only way to describe it.
You mentioned there little elements of the Harvard. What was the visibility like from the cockpit?
Very good. Oh, it was excellent. I mean, you've got a lovely view forward. The wing was slightly back from the pilot, so you could look down just, you know, in front of the wing, more or less directly to one side. The thing that sort of frightened all of us, though, when we first saw it, having come from a very, very basic Tiger Moth, you sit in the cockpit of a Harvard and it's one mass of instruments and switches and dials and tits and things to put, all sorts of things, which you think yourself, you're never ever going to master all these things. But you did. I mean, it just became second nature to you after a bit. You had a full blind flying panel which had got everything on it, gyro control, altimeters, turn and bank indicators, position, everything was there. And it was, you know, you very quickly mastered these things. And then on one side, you'd obviously got controls for radio. Another side, you'd got controls for when you were going to go dropping practice bombs and all sorts of, lots of little switches which you didn't normally worry about. But the basics you very quickly got to know.
You mentioned that it had a control for different pitch.
Yes.
Can you explain pitch to me and how that works?
Without being able to see what I'm saying, you'll find it difficult. But the propeller spins, and if it's in fine pitch, the propeller blades are turned. And fine pitch means that the angle that the propeller is making as it goes through the air is quite fine. It's a very fine pitch, and that is when you want to get full power out of the aeroplane, you put it into fine pitch, and that you always use for taking off and landing. You always are in fine pitch. Now, once you've got comfortably settled in the air, you pull the pitch lever back, and that broadens the angle of the blade so that it's making a much more like a paddle effect in the air. And that means that you're flying much more economically because the fuel is not being swallowed up, and you don't need fine pitch all the time. If you did, you'd probably wear the engine out too quickly. So you fly normally in a lower pitch. And right at the very bottom of the scale, about as low as you can get, and I can't tell you the actual revs now, is if you were in a situation where you were running short of fuel and you were lost or something like that, and you were desperately trying to keep the time that you could stay in the air, you would fly in a very coarse pitch with probably a bit more power on just to keep the aeroplane flying at a minimum speed. But it becomes second nature to you, this pitch. And it's one of the drills that you always use when you take off and landing to make sure that you're in fine pitch. And I could tell you some stories about people who weren't in fine pitch later on, but there we are.
And again, you said it had flaps.
Yes.
What are the purpose of flaps?
Flaps are underneath the wing. They're normally housed so that they're flush with the wing. But you can extend the flaps by a flap control lever in the cockpit, obviously. And when they are fully extended to the fully down position, that gives you a greater area of wing area, so that it means that you can fly the aeroplane more slowly. And always used, well, I say always used, but normally it's used when you're landing. You put full flap on, it means the aeroplane is slowed down, but you've still got full control over it. Somewhere in between, and I can't remember whether the Harvard allowed you to do this, but in later aeroplanes, there's an intermediate position, which is a takeoff position, where the flaps are sort of halfway lowered. And that will again give you more lift. In other words, it's increasing the area of the wing and gives you a bit more lift. But again, it's part of the drill. You make sure when you're taking off that you've either got flaps fully housed, or if you need a bit of extra lift, you can put takeoff flap down. I can't remember in the Harvard whether you could select the intermediate position or not.
How did you communicate with your instructor?
Again, I think I'm right, and I stand to be corrected here. I think, again, initially it was purely with these Gosport tubes like we had in the Tiger Moth. But later on we flew aeroplanes with radios in. And then, of course, you had a microphone where you could broadcast to the outside world, or if you didn't switch it on, you just talked to the instructor. But No, I can't. I wish I could remember that one.
Can you take me through, obviously, once you'd had your familiarisation flight, the kind of process that you would do to take off when you arrive at the aircraft? What do you have to do with your checks? Do you have to sign anything? Do you have to go around again? And what are you checking on a Harvard as opposed to sort of a Tiger Moth?
Well, the first thing about you have to sign anything, if you are the captain of the aircraft, and this happens all through your flying career, there is a form, I think it's called Form 700. Each aeroplane has its own logbook, as it were, which you don't fly with it normally anyway. That's kept in the crew room. And when you are allocated to fly a certain aeroplane, you get that logbook, or the ground crew have got it ready for you. You check it. And in there, the various ground crew members have done their checks on it. They've done the engine, they've done the all the rigging and all these sort of things are done. And they've signed that the aircraft is fully serviceable. It also mentions the amount of fuel. The amount of fuel that's in there, so you can check all these things that they're in order, and then you sign that you have accepted the aircraft. So you are then responsible for the aircraft, and they've done their bit, you've taken it over. So that's the first thing. You then go out to the aeroplane and you do your walk round checks. It's the same as we've always been taught. Check all the various controls.